Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Is the two-party political system the solution to America's problems with debt, unemployment, education, and health care, or the source of them? While multiple generations have engaged in the fractious divide between Republican and Democratic lawmakers, my guest today would remind us that there is no reason to believe it will last forever, particularly in light of recent polls that show a growing number of Americans no longer strongly identify with either party. And given the issues that concern us most these days, he says a libertarian approach to running the country could not only solve many of our financial problems, but could also release us from our obsession with political conflict. Matt Welch is editor-in-chief of Reason magazine. His new book, written with Nick Gillespie of Reason.com and Reason TV, is called The Declaration of Independence: How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Matt, welcome to Think.
Thanks so much for having me.
So you remind us here that the Constitution promises life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness, and not life, liberty, and the watching of Meet the Press. Do you really think our obsession with two-party politics is making us miserable?
I don't think it's improving much of anything, except for those who take it as a purely spectator sport. We confuse, I think, politics with the stuff that has meaning. I mean, politicians... How many times have you heard a politician describe their own approach and the approach of those who just give them money as, you know, selfless public service? There are a lot of different ways to serve the public, but running for and winning elections and then, you know, directing the lives of the people who lost the election doesn't necessarily rank high among that. But more importantly, those who kind of obsess with the tribal, you know, pendulum swing back and forth, who the type of people basically who in 2011 think raising the debt ceiling is a terrible idea, but in 2006 said it was totally essential, and I think you know who I'm talking about, and vice versa. It's not a healthy way to think about things, and it's also not the shortcut to the solutions, particularly of those problems that are most intractable right now. And fiscal policy is definitely one of them, but it's certainly not the only one. Wherever you see a kind of roadblock and consistently bad performance and bad results in not just government but modern American life, those are usually areas where politics is the least responsive to concerns of people, of individuals, and also where government is most involved. And so it's a shortcut. You get there quicker to reform those things when you stop believing that the solution is, you know, rooting for your political team even harder. In fact, we argue in the book that tactically probably the best way to break up some of those log jams is to declare independence from politics and from those parties. Even if you are registered to one or lean in one direction, you can have more impact on the kind of issues that you really care about if you are no longer a guaranteed vote and a guaranteed supporter, if you work outside of the channels of politics and use the kind of insights that we've learned everywhere else outside of politics and kind of foist it on our public policy.
Well, we've arrived at an interesting moment in this country because, as I alluded to in the introduction, there are a growing number of Americans who say, I'm not a Republican, I'm not a Democrat. We know that those people who are not declared partisans have a lot of influence these days in deciding the outcome of elections. But isn't it true that most of those people, while they may not say they are a Democrat or they are a Republican, they are much more likely to vote for one party or the other in multiple elections?
Yes and no. In terms of basic kind of political makeup and polarization, independents, who are now the largest block of voters, according to Pew, according to Gallup, and they're almost the largest according to the Harris poll. These are three organizations that have been measuring this for a long time. Just in terms of people's basic affiliation, regardless of who they're registered for, so they're. Tendency towards a political belief and polarization tends to be similar to that of people within parties. However, they do swing elections, and they swing from party to party. Independents totally backed Democrats in 2006 and in 2008 in congressional elections. They flipped, and they joined Republicans in 2010. They were, as recently as 3 years ago, 60-plus percent of independents backed Barack Obama. Now it's in the 30s. Somewhere. They are the swing vote right now. And a a large and growing number of them are those who we would identify as being kind of fiscally conservative and socially tolerant, which is sort of libertarian without calling itself libertarian in a way. I mean, the basic libertarian impulse is, as the motto of our magazine is, it's free minds and free markets, limiting government's reach in boardroom and bedroom alike. That's an increasing number of Americans are going that way. You can measure it as much as 59% call themselves that. Hardcore kind of, or more specifically libertarian population is more like 14%. And libertarians themselves no longer are really a reliable Republican vote as they were during the Cold War. The majority of libertarians are close to it now, define themselves as independent. So it's taking on kind of a new speciation or emphases, this block of libertarians. And let's remember, people who generally describe our politics, including journalists who don't necessarily have a public identification with one tribe or another, but the overwhelming kind of bias within that system is a bias towards people who think in terms of the two parties and the system kind of perpetuating like that. That creates kind of a built-in bias against the independents. You see people like Michael Kazin on the left in the New Republic, or Jonah Goldberg on the right in National Review, talking about how independents are just ill-informed people, you know, and it's terrible that we allow these malinformed ne'er-do-wells tip our elections. We argue in the book that disaffiliating with the two major parties, it makes sense. It's actually a rational act in addition to being, it's a rational response to bad policy from both parties and similar policies that both parties enact once they're in power, and that it makes sense to, if you speed up that process, then you speed up the ability of people to actually fix the very things that turn them off the parties in the first place.
So talk about this, Matt. Even though the political parties continue to lumber on in their entrenched fashion, individuals in this country are moving toward ever greater degrees of freedom and independence, at least culturally and economically.
Sure, and it's one of the greatest things about modern life. I mean, it seems like a complete anachronism, different world altogether, but it was really only about 12 years ago when we were all sitting around and saying, oh, my God, what's going to happen when Ellen comes out as gay on television? You know, and are there any networks left that don't have some kind of gay character or gay-themed show somewhere along the lines? I mean, the tolerance and kind of cultural speciation, hyphenation, is expanding just exponentially right now. And with that come changes in attitudes towards things like gay marriage, towards, you know, just interracial dating. I mean, I don't think people even use the word interracial anymore. And that is changing so much faster than I think we even realize. And it makes sense because we have a world of kind of infinite choice in the marketplace in our, you know, if you're a 14-year-old, you know, gay goth kid in Wichita, Kansas, you have so many different avenues for meeting other people like you. You can transcend your geography. You can transcend everything. It's just a much more rich possibility out there in our lives. And it is changing the sort of social dynamic, but it's also changing our basic expectations. We think, rightfully so, that we should be able to control our consumer experience and even sort of direct it, control the means of production ourselves, cultural production. You know, people don't just passively sit and, you know, watch one of the 577 channels. They mix it up themselves and they repackage it and throw it up on YouTube and become superstars or not. But we control our environment so much more, and now we expect that kind of experience, or we're going to continue to demand that kind of experience in places where we have much more frustrations, and that tends to be places where the government has a big role. You know, DMV experiences is everyone's go-to, nightmare scenario. Well, it's not necessarily true that going to Amazon.com is a nightmare scenario. It's something that you can tailor and fit your own needs and this kind of thing. So the future of policy and kind of culture and in many senses, you know, government and politics are a complete lagging indicator of where America is going. And so I think we're all going in that direction. And the broad view of policy, both in America and especially abroad, is going in a direction where it's the individual who's at the focus of things, not necessarily a state that's imposing its view. So it's a matter of time before politics and governance has to get with that particular program, because that's the world that we've created and have grown to expect. And it's a better world, frankly.
So it's one thing, Matt, to desire freedom in who we socialize with and how we spend our time and what we choose to purchase. It's another thing. I mean, do you see that also translating to a greater acceptance of personal responsibility for our own well-being?
I would hope so, yeah. And a desire or a demand to change that. Look at one of the kind of most intractable public policy problems in the country, K-12 education, mm-hmm. right? We all know the numbers. Since 1970, we're spending as much as three times as much per pupil adjusted for inflation, and the test scores are exactly the same. Nothing has moved that needle, yet we're spending three times as much. So what are people doing? Even, you know, forget about people like me who are going to talk about various solutions to it, having to do with, you know, putting the money in a kid's backpack and letting them choose the school and letting that kind of individualized competition enter into the scenario. But look what people are doing already. They are increasingly, and in numbers that are just exploding, using online education. Homeschooling started taking off in the last decade. Charter schools have, you know, started from zero 10 years ago to, you know, in some places kind of dominating the public education system. In New Orleans, post-Katrina now, it's a whole district full of school choice, and everything is a charter school, basically. So people are already creating and designing their own experiences to meet their needs instead of being sentenced to their neighborhood school. What that does, it creates competition for the first time in a long time, and more of an experience among people saying, hey, why can't we replicate this everywhere, so that not just people with means or people with a lot of drive can have this experience. We still have 90% of kids go to their neighborhood school, period, and don't really have an option. So you're already having that kind of self-tailoring and people pushing on that door, on that locked door. The next step is for them to learn from that experience enough to demand change through the front door. And that's a lot of what our book talks about.
So if government doesn't maintain quite the same role in structuring public education, what happens to the role of government in holding public education systems accountable?
Well, there's a lot of different systems for doing that, and a lot of different kind of debate over that. I think we've just seen recently in Atlanta and in many other school districts, the kind of No Child Left Behind federal top-down approach with testing-based results can create incentives for people to cheat widespread. I tend to believe that you're not going to get the best results if it's the federal government coming up with like a national curriculum, which is they're actually talking about right now. It's kind of under the radar screen. We have something like 10% the number of school districts as we had, 50 or 60 years ago. Still, most spending on education happens at the state and local level. I think that's as it should be. And, each place will find its own system of accountability. But think about what we have now. Think about the status quo. You have a system where if a school district like New York needs to cut back on personnel, they have to fire the most recently hired teachers first, and not the people who are in rubber rooms because no one wants to have them get anywhere near a kid. The system right now is so broken that the word accountability even sounds crazy when you're talking about it. It's gone so out of whack that we need to kind of rip it up and rethink. And that could involve spending the exact same amount of money as we do now. But if we create more of a competitive environment to allow people to individualize their experience, it's going to create much better outcomes.
Matt Welch is my guest. He's editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine and co-author of the new book, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Co-author on that is Nick Gillespie. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a multidisciplinary program that allows you the intellectual freedom to design your own master's degree. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is Matt Welch. He's editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine and co-author, along with Nick Gillespie, of The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. If you'd like to join us, you can call in to 1-800-933-5372 or send email to think@kera.org. Matt, in even imagining a different sort of America and a different organization for the political system, it's something that's challenging to do because all of us, you and I having this conversation, and certainly people listening to the program who were raised in this country, can only remember a political system where there were Republicans and there were Democrats and there were smaller, less influential independent parties. You remind us here, and you have examples from business and also the geopolitical realm, that you know, bipolar systems of power can and do change all the time.
Yeah, we tend to have what we sort of call existence bias or status quo bias, where we are convinced that the world around us, even though we know somewhere in our heart of hearts that it's a dynamic place, which it is, but somehow that the structure that we have today is going to be the structure that we live on tomorrow. And especially the closer you get to real big kind of tectonic change, it's almost the fewer or the less frequent that people can identify it happen, even participants. One example I use is in August of 1989, the Czech economist, a free market economist named Václav Klaus, was asked, okay, so do you think communism is going to end anytime? And he said, not in my lifetime. Hmm. And within 6 months, he was the first finance minister of a free Czechoslovakia. These kinds of changes are huge in more kind of pedestrian American political contexts. In the entire year of 2007, the front runners, by acclamation and also by polls and everything else, for the presidential campaign were Hillary Clinton and Rudolph Giuliani. And on the Iowa electronic markets, the kind of crowdsourced online trading thing, Giuliani was the number one Republican every week in 2007, except for one. And in fact, that exchange never did get around to including on its list Ron Paul, who crushed Giuliani like a bug on the windshield, ultimately, and in a way that no one was predicting, no one expected. So things do change, and they change pretty fast. I mean, you and I grew up, I presume, during the Cold War, and we kind of thought that was going to last forever until the day that it didn't, and then suddenly the world looks kind of different. It doesn't mean necessarily that we're going to end the two-party system. I think that we have a two-party system for a reason. It's kind of structurally built into the Constitution. We are, you know, appropriately not a parliamentary system. So you're going to have groups and tendencies like this. But the question is, what's going to happen to that? And will they continue to be able to ignore very important strains within each camp? And we argue in the book that with the advent of technology and people's abilities to root around things and kind of swarm using the internet and other things on issues that they care about, that it's no longer possible. And so every 2 years, basically, you have some new phenomenon that comes out of left field. Right now, it's kind of the Tea Party movement. In 2004, it was the Howard Dean anti-war movement. And these little epiphenomena always have the same kind of characteristics. No one predicted them. They're super online savvy, and they kind of jolt politics, even if they don't entirely take it over. We argue that, again, that that's a good thing because it's an example of, on the Tea Party side, of them reminding the Republican half, hey, look, you used to be for limited government. That used to be a passion, conscious of a conservative by Barry Goldwater and all of that, and you just flouted that for 15 years. You didn't govern like that at all. And the Howard Dean and kind of anti-war left reminded Democrats, you've been promiscuous with your war making for a long time, and that is against an important constituency on the left. And an important difference between the kind of successes of both of those two examples is that the Tea Party has refused to stay on the reservation in terms of being Republican through and through. They are willing and able to nominate or back crazy people who have no chance of winning against the Democrat as long as that person is good on their issue. The Howard Dean side got completely subsumed in the Democratic Party. He became chair of the National Party. And as a result, we now have a Democratic president who they all backed, but he's starting wars again and extending existing ones, and there isn't any anti-war left anymore. So I think people are going to learn from that tactically. And in 2012 already, you're going to see, I think, on the left, some people peeling off and recognizing that their way to affect issues that they care about, and drug policy and the drug war is a big one that I think will come into play. It's now a lot more wide open, and that's a good thing.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have a full board of calls, so we'll get to some of those now. Let's go first to Bill in Dallas. Hello, Bill.
Hi, Matt. I just recently visited Sweden, and I was very impressed. You know, it was a very quick survey of the country, but I was very impressed with how things are there with the general, what I perceive to be the happiness of that population. I know that that's basically a socialist country, but, you know, I asked our tour guide, how much do they pay in taxes there? And she said 33%, you know, and I said, well, I'm basically paying that now, and I'm not getting anything like what they get. And what do you see as the problems of Sweden in terms of libertarianism? I would consider myself a libertarian, but I would be willing to pay that much in taxes to get those types of programs. As I see it, the differences between the countries are we have an extreme religious conservative population in this country that blocks a lot of social programs, and they have the absolute inverse. They have perhaps 90% of non-religious. So what do you think is the situation there, and whether we could ever achieve anything like that?
Scandinavia is a pretty interesting model because what they have is much less in terms of corporate regulations, business regulations, much lower corporate taxes. It's a freer climate to run a business in many ways, unless you're working in like heavily regulated areas like alcohol consumption. This is Scandinavia writ large, Sweden included. And at the same time, they have a generous welfare state. They see the role of government is to help provide for education and help with health care, just sort of focus on core areas there, but with a light touch on regulation so that business can thrive and flourish. Makes things more complicated to discuss, that most of the countries there also are sitting on and profiting from a hell of a lot of oil reserves. Norway is the classic example of that, but I'm pretty sure Sweden has some pretty good energy bounty, too, that kind of allows them to have this combination. It's interesting. I think it's not something that we could easily replicate here. It's also true that in places like Sweden and generally both Scandinavia and Western Europe, that what they do now and how they operate their economies now is a sea change difference than it was 20 years ago. 20 years ago, all of Western Europe was much more statist. I mean, a lot of American conservatives love to make fun of Europe and all their regulations. But in fact, Europe has been deregulating like crazy since the 1990s. No longer do you have like national airlines and the government's running media and all these kinds of artifacts of post-war Western Europe, and so they freed up large sections of the economy, and the velocity continues to go in that direction. Right now they've lapped us in things like airline deregulation, where we had once led the world and kind of unleashed Southwest Airlines on the non-Texas part of America. The low-cost airline capital of the world is Europe, and the European Union, and Eastern Europe even, and not America, because they've continued to free up their economy. So it is an interesting case study. There are elements of it that I don't find copacetic. They tend to be more kind of socially. They look for a kind of social cohesion that I don't think is appropriate in an American context. But they're certainly interesting to look at. Switzerland is another place, an interesting case study of how to organize your economy. But thank you for the question.
Well, as you state in the book, it helps your point of view that we simply can't afford to do things the way that we have been doing them for several generations now. Though, when the economy inevitably turns around and revenues increase even without raising tax rates, do you imagine that Americans will continue to maintain this appetite for more libertarian approaches to government?
They're just, even if tomorrow we got out of this economic and fiscal crisis, according to the president's own team and according to Ben Bernanke, according to the president himself, our current fiscal trajectory, given what we've promised to people, is, quote, unsustainable, unquote. We can't keep going this way. And at heart, everyone kind of knows this, and we're starting to finally develop a political appetite for talking about this and not just in polite company, but in public. But we can't afford it. I mean, that, you know, the fact of education costing 2.5-3 times as much, repeat that over a broad swath. I mean, George W. Bush increased the size of the federal government by 60% during his term. 60, as adjusted for inflation. And it's not just defense, and it's not just war. It's everything. And Obama has just kind of doubled down on that, increased that velocity. We can't afford that. And then now we're making all these promises with entitlements that we all know are impossible to maintain with the baby boomers retiring. So there is going to be plenty of market out there. And it's not just, you know, that we've got these harebrained ideas that finally have reached, have got the crisis that we need to focus people's attention. But look at the gap between the general kind of Washington idea about what we should do, even about the debt ceiling, and public opinion in America over the last 3 or 4 years. Americans have been dead set against bailout economics and you know, the too big to fail and socializing risks that go bad and all this kind of stuff. There's been clear majorities against all of that. Yet Washington, no matter who's in power, ends up keeps going down that path. So there is a large political will right now out there among people who don't hold power. They feel like their interests are no longer aligned with those of their politicians. That creates a very dynamic situation, and we're going to finally see a politics where people are openly winning elections, such as Rand Paul in Kentucky. He's a great example. He ran against his own party, his handpicked successor, right, Mitch McConnell, who runs the Senate. And he ran by saying we can't afford Medicare and Social Security as it stands. And he won, and he beat all expectations, and now he's talking about that and other stuff like the Patriot Act and the war in the Senate. So it's possible to change those politics now, because I think Americans instinctively think that something has gone off the rails policy-wise.
Back to the phones now at 1-800-933-5372. We have Thomas on the line in Dallas. Hi, Thomas.
Hi. Yeah, I appreciate much of the libertarian message. I voted for Bednarik and Ron Paul. But you made a comparison, which is a major flaw that's even in the name of your deal, free markets. There's not a free market. There's 3 or 4 markets. There's a free market. I'm in it. I'm a landscaper. I've got competition and alternatives, and the customer's always right. Your comparison of Amazon, which is in the free market, to the DMV is ludicrous. You also have the professional market, where there's no alternative, but there's competition. Usually they're self-regulating. Then you have the utility monopoly market. And here you have no competition, no choice. This operates just like the DMV. You want to compare something to the DMV, compare it to the electric company, the cable company, where you need a tube of KY for customer service. Those are different market structures. There's no competition, no alternatives. You can't compare them. Then you have two special markets, banking and healthcare. And I'll say that Hayek believed in national healthcare. And so these markets are different. I'm sorry, the libertarians, who mostly are professionals in journalism, which is pretty weak on the fiduciary role, don't seem to understand the difference in the markets.
Well, you put a lot on the table, so let's get a response.
Au contraire. I mean, I'm someone who has written in a libertarian publication of why I prefer French healthcare, for example. And I, for one, although it's not shared by everyone who self-identifies as libertarian, think that there is a role for a welfare state and for the government to get involved in healthcare. Yes, the DMV is a different market than Amazon, but there we don't have to have a situation where there's only one government agency that handles the licensing and permits and things like that. In California, or where I'm from originally, you know, I can get most of that stuff done at the AAA. You can't do that in most places in the country necessarily. So you can inject competition. No, it's not a perfect analogy. What I'm talking about is, in any given situation, can you inject competition to it? And cable, you mentioned that would be something that's more analogous. And yet, look at, you know, yes, it's really expensive to lay a wire under the ground, and you might not in the first year or two or three have any other provider for that. But now what happens? Wireless comes in, and suddenly cable has had to change their, you know, recalcitrant monopolistic tactics. We are evolving and changing, and the question is, how can we, at what point can we inject more of a kind of consumer-oriented experience in the provision of public policies? It doesn't mean that, you know, every single bit of government is going to resemble in any way Amazon.com. But it does mean that the central insight of Amazon, which is that it's a very personalized, individualized experience, has something to offer or tell us about an approach that we might use in other kinds of provisions of public policies.
What role do you see, Matt, in a more libertarian state than we have today, in a more libertarian system of government for consumer protections?
You know, I think transparency in general is a great goal, and I wish that the government itself would embrace it a lot more. And, you know, to the extent which you're going to have government involved in what's happening, it would be to encourage, depending on what sector you're talking about, people just to sort of list things, list ingredients, whatever, so that we know what is being bought and sold at any given time. I don't think that you need it to the extent that, you know, a kid selling lemonade needs to list their ingredients on a cup. Basically, you know, encouragement to transparency is a thing. And government is always going to be there adjudicating disputes and being a source of, you know, if you violated this contract, you can sue this person. Or if you damage this person, you can sue that person. Or if you cause some kind of intentional distress or fraud, we have police for that, you know. I think the problem is that right now we are living in an area that is so far away from whatever, you know, my ideal might be. And perhaps that's a good thing. I'm sure a lot of listeners would think that's a good thing. But we have now kind of the expectation that government is going to be in or near so many different transactions. And, you know, I use lemonade stands facetiously, but there are two cases in the country this week where little girls, you know, had their lemonade stand shut down in Appleton, Wisconsin, and in, I think, Macon, Georgia. We have grown to accept too much of a sort of default intrusion in areas where people left alone are going to do just fine.
Matt Welch is my guest. He's editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine and co-author, along with Nick Gillespie, of the new book, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. We'll come back to our conversation in a couple of minutes. You can send email to us at think@kera.org. Telephone number is 1-800-933-5372.
Funding for Think comes from SMU's Master of Liberal Studies, a self-designed program that allows an unconventional approach to your graduate education. You can learn more at smu.edu/MLS.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. My guest this hour is editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine, Matt Welch. His new book is called The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Our telephone number is 1-800-933-5372. Let's go back to the phones now, and this time we will speak with Jason in Carrollton. Hi, Jason.
Hello.
Hi, Jason. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, I actually had two questions. One, I wanted to know what your perception was of how all the political parties in America, not just the faded two-party system, are looking at the disenfranchisement of America and its voters as a whole. And the other is, what is the perception, the possibility of eliminating the Electoral College?
You know, I think that eliminating the Electoral College as in the world that we live in right now, is not going anywhere. Maybe a crisis that we can't currently imagine will fall down on our head and shoulders, and we'll have a different view on it altogether. I mean, 4 years ago, if you had asked me whether we were going to have an audit the Federal Reserve bill pass through Congress, I would have called you a crazy person, and yet we've had one of those. In general, I mean, I guess I would ask, what do you mean by disenfranchisement? Specifically,
well, I guess what I'm saying is that most voters are looking at the okay. Let me speak for myself here. Looking at the different parties and what they quote unquote represent, and what the core values are of what the parties are as a whole don't seem to line up with the rhetoric that they're saying on TV.
So you're talking about a willful disenfranchisement where people choose not to vote because no one seems to represent their
views. Or they vote for someone and they don't get what they think that they bought mm-hmm. in some ways, which is another form of disenfranchisement perhaps.
So what do you think about that, Matt?
I think it is true, and we talk about this in the book, that, both parties, generally speaking, are not what they sell themselves at or even tell themselves that they are. It might hurt people's feelings or ears, but Republicans are not either for free enterprise or limited government, and Democrats aren't for a more humble foreign policy or respect for civil liberties or even free speech. They're just not. Once they're in power, that's what changes the calculus, and there are a number of incentives, including just the normal temptations of power, that, once you get there, suddenly you're not going to close down Guantanamo Bay after all, are you? And you're actually going to add troops to Afghanistan, and you're going to perpetuate the policies that you ran against. We've had the last, 3 presidents, basically, that we've had all ran on some degree to a more scaled-back, more humble foreign policy, and yet there hasn't been anything except a generalized, mission creep and acceleration of American involvement and promiscuousness abroad, because life looks different when you have power. So the good news about all this is that for those who feel disenfranchised, now there is the possibility of developing the whip hand by saying that I'm not going to stay on this team. I'm not going to live my life by the ups and downs and fortunes of the political party, but I'm going to stick to the one or two issues that I care about most, find allies from wherever the hell who also agree on that, and then try to change the conversation. In that sense, we can finally get the political parties to start working more for us, honoring their own traditions in a way, and breaking up some of the bad policy logjams that we've seen.
Do you think the issue, though, Matt, is that suddenly people attain public office and they realize they have all this power and they take it and run with it? Or is it the reality that pragmatically, regardless of what they've campaigned on, when they get into the places, particularly in the legislature, where other people are sharing power with them, they have to bend in order to get anything done?
It's kind of a combination of it all, I guess. Mm-hmm. Some of it is just if you have a built-in structure and various, government, kind of the permanent government that sits here in Washington, among other places, and in state capitals, too, it is actually kind of a pain to really change correction. But also because, think about it, how many people have gained political power by doing less? It doesn't usually work that way. The way that you win favor and maintain office and power, generally speaking, is that you spend more money on certain constituencies who can then help you stay in power. It's an incentive problem. There's an entire wing of economics that looks at this, public choice economics, that I encourage people to explore, and it's difficult. The incentives are all screwed up. They're much more likely to help out a single, influential donor than help out the millions of people who get hurt just a little bit by what that donor does. So it is a vexing problem, but one way that you can help begin to fix it is to remind the people early and often, not just of their broken promises, but how that their broken promises and bad policies are hurting not just America, but their own political supporters or base of support.
So given all those vexing problems, what convinces you that we are, as you write in the book, on the cusp of a libertarian moment?
Cockeyed Californian optimism and insanity on one sense. Another is just that, pull the periscope back a little bit. If you would have told me in 1971 that we were going to, at a time when Richard Nixon was in office, abusing power like crazy, he had just enacted wage and price controls, we're mired in Vietnam. If you would have told me we were going to, within a matter of years, get out of Vietnam, end the military draft, and have a liberal consensus of Jimmy Carter, Ted Kennedy, Ralph Nader, and others, deregulate the airline and trucking industries and begin to deregulate, beer making and media, I would have called you an absolutely insane person. And yet that's kind of where the sweep of history is going. Internationally, we've had an unprecedented surge in freedom and prosperity. People have been lifted out of poverty. 500 million people in China and India, in the last decade alone, Communism fell. Things get better. You know, we get richer and more prosperous. Everyone has air conditioning except me and when I live in L.A. But in 1970, we didn't. We're richer, more prosperous, more varied. So the broad sweep says we are going in the right direction. And then also, as you alluded to earlier, we're in such a pickle right now with the fiscal situation that something's got to give. And my hunch is that given the fact that so many people in America are dissatisfied with economic and fiscal policy right now, that we're going to see a change sometime soon. It seems like we just have to. And I have hopes that that change is going to produce, finally, policies and outcomes that are much better than the slog that we've had these last dreary 10 years.
Back to the phones now. This time we have Don on the line in Dallas. Hello, Don.
Hey, how you doing? I have one question, and I'll preface it with a comment. Twice the guest has said that we're better off in the recent past. His last comment was in the past 30 years, the progress and the tide of economic freedom. In the past 30 years, the economic life of the people in the U.S., the middle class, by every measure, has gone down. Wages are less. Unionization is less. But at that same time, you've seen the march of deregulation. Everywhere you see the march of deregulation, which is basically libertarianism, you see a reduction of the power of the people who have to work for a living. How do you tell me that libertarianism and the unshackling of business leads to a better life for the average person?
Well, first I would say that calling deregulation the unshackling of business is a vast misunderstanding of the concept. When airlines were deregulated in the 1970s, something that every Texan should be proud of because they were part of it, it was the existing four airlines that had dominated commercial air travel for four decades who were squawking the loudest about it. They didn't want that to happen because when government colludes with big business in a corporatist mindset, then it basically locks into power those biggest corporations. The people who won were, as ever, consumers. It was people who wanted to fly and couldn't because it was too expensive before. Suddenly, with the advent of deregulation, Southwest could transcend its boundaries out of Texas and elsewhere. That's usually the pattern in deregulation. It's not something that big business wants. It's usually big business who squawks loudest of all. It's something that consumers want and people who actually like competition, including the freedom to fail. Those are the people who are supporting that. That's one. And another, you know, the average median income in this country in 1970 was $15,000 adjusted for inflation. Right now it's $28,000. That's a real gain. You can look at stats and say that the median middle-class earner is still in the median and has been for 30 years. There's a very open question about how mobile they are going up and down the scale. Generally speaking, in America, there's a lot more upward or dynamic mobility. You can get poorer, you can get richer than in other countries. And I don't see any correlation personally between the rates of unionization and prosperity. I think it's kind of a misnomer to assume that those things go hand in hand in general. In terms of purchasing power, in terms of the things that we can do compared to what we were able to do 30 or 40 years ago, the quality of the goods that we have, having refrigerators in your homes, all that kind of stuff, we are incredibly better off now than we were 30 and 40 years ago, even in a moment right now, which is basically the worst moment that we've had since the kind of Carter-Reagan handoff then, and arguably even since the Great Depression. So I think that we're inarguably better off. And not only that, we stopped deregulation. I mean, it's not like that continued. It was something that happened with a burst of enthusiasm in the 70s, again, led by the left at the time. And now it's become a dirty word, and I think that's an unfortunate thing.
Let's go back before we end this hour and talk a little bit about changing and reforming the retirement system we have in this country with regard to entitlement programs. A lot of people recognize that it's not sustainable financially, but how do we sort of begin to unlatch, if we do, from the promises we've made to people who have not saved adequately to do this any other way than through government entitlement?
It's a hard question. If it was easy, we would have gotten there already. I mean, first, I think everyone acknowledges that you have to bump up the retirement age. At the time that this was enacted, people, you know, on average died around retirement age, and certainly worked up until the final moments that they were able to work. That's different now. People live much, much longer. They stop working. They have a longer retirement. It's one of the many reasons why the just sort of actuarial tables of this are so deadly for the rest of us. I think you're going to have to get into means testing on some level. You're going to have to say that, look, Warren Buffett, sorry, you're not getting that check, pal, thanks for everything. And there will be great resistance to that, because once you introduce those concepts that, like, that this is not as mandatory, that is not as guaranteed, then it's going to bust up the political consensus for keeping the status quo. I would argue that that's a good thing, but there are many entrenched interests who would say, no, we can't touch that. You know, if everyone has to pay in and has to get it back on the receiving end, then that creates a different political dynamic, but we just can't afford it. So means test, you know, increase the age. I would love to see a system in some day where you would allow young workers to opt out, because they're not going to get the money. You know, my 20-something-year-old sister is not going to get her full payout. I think everyone acknowledges that in their heart of hearts. So if she had the option to say, no, I'd like to keep that 12.5%, thank you very much, I'd love to see that. That right now is a political non-starter. It's not going anywhere. So at least for the moment, kind of stretch it out, start talking about means testing and making for a later retirement age.
What do you see as the ultimate outcome of this ongoing tension between the GOP and the Tea Party?
That's a really good question. I don't know. You know, it's the Tea Party has, regardless of whether you love it or hate it, from a tactical point of view, I think it's been really fascinating. And we talk about that at some length in the book, and like what lessons the left can learn from it. I think that they can learn many. I think it has changed, certainly, the tenor of Republicans in Washington. The class that got elected in 2010 is just different. Different types of people who are scrambling people's brains. You know, for the first time in almost my lifetime, we have Republicans on Capitol Hill talking about cutting the defense budget. Granted, it's a handful. It is really not much, but that is already kind of a different thing. I tend to think that that is where the action continues to be and the grassroots passion continues to be. So there are going to be more people who affiliate with the Tea Party. The big question, I think, ultimately is, will the Tea Party maintain its own message discipline of focusing on limiting and cutting the size of government and constitutionalism, or will it get sucked into more kind of divisive and controversial questions of foreign policy and social issues? So far, I think for the most part, it has maintained that focus, which is where its strength comes from. If it loses, you know, drifts the eye from the ball or whatever, then I think it's going to dissipate in power. But also, that's, you know, I'm speaking out of personal hope here, too. So take it all with a grain of salt.
Matt Welch is editor-in-chief of Reason Magazine and co-author of the new book, The Declaration of Independence, How Libertarian Politics Can Fix What's Wrong with America. Matt, a really interesting discussion. Thank you so much for spending this hour with
us. Thanks so much for having me. It was great fun.
My name is Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening, and have a great day.
The Think production team includes engineer Nilofer Arsala. Our senior producer is Jeff Whittington. Learn more about today's show, find out about upcoming programs, and download our free daily podcasts at kera.org/think. And we'd like to hear what you think about Think. Email your comments, questions, and suggestions to think@kera.org.